Chapter 40 of Impatience. I went home. Straight home to my rooms, he said distinctly. The coolness of the man. You dared? Why not? I assure you I was perfectly calm. Ha! Calmer than I am now, perhaps. I like you much better as you are now than when you indulge that bitter vein of yours, Razumov. And nobody in the house saw you return, eh? That might have appeared queer. No one, Razumov said firmly. Vornik, landlady, girl, all out of the way. I went up like a shadow. It was a murky morning. The stairs were dark. I glided up like a phantom. Fate? Luck? What do you think? I just see it. The eyes of the woman revolutionist snapped darkly. Oh, and then you considered. Dot, dot, Razumov had it already in his head. No. I looked at my watch, since you want to know. There was just time. I took that notebook, and ran down the stairs on tiptoe. Have you ever listened to the pit-pat of a man running round, and round the shaft of a deep staircase? They have a gaslight at the bottom burning night and day. I suppose it's gleaming down there now. Dot dot dot, the sound dies out, the flame winks. Dot dot, he noticed the vacillation of surprise passing over the steady curiosity of the black eyes fastened on his face, as if the woman revolutionist received the sound of his voice into her pupils instead of her ears. He checked himself, passed his hand over his forehead, confused, like a man who has been dreaming aloud. Where could a student be running, if not to his lectures in the morning? At night it's another matter. I did not care, if all the house had been there to look at me. But I don't suppose there was anyone. It's best not to be seen or heard. Aha! The people that are neither seen, nor heard are the lucky ones in Russia. Don't you admire my luck? Astonishing, she said. If you have luck as well as determination, then indeed you are likely to turn out an invaluable acquisition for the work in hand. Her tone was earnest, and it seemed to Razumov that it was speculative, even as though she were already apportioning him, in her mind, his share of the work. Her eyes were cast down. He waited, not very alert now, but with the grip of the ever-present danger giving him an air of attentive gravity. Who could have written about him in that letter from Petersburg? A fellow student, surely some imbecile victim of revolutionary propaganda, some foolish slave of foreign, subversive ideals. A long, famine-stricken, red-nosed figure presented itself to his mental search. That must have been the fellow. He smiled inwardly at the absolute wrong-headedness of the whole thing, the self-deception of a criminal idealist shattering his existence like a thunderclap out of a clear sky, and re-echoing amongst the wreckage in the false assumptions of those other fools. Fancy that hungry and piteous imbecile furnishing to the curiosity of the revolutionist refugees this utterly fantastic detail. He appreciated it, as by no means constituting a danger. On the contrary. As things stood, it was for his advantage rather, a piece of sinister luck which had only to be accepted with proper caution. And yet, Razumov, he heard the musing voice of the woman, you have not the face of a lucky man. She raised her eyes with renewed interest. And so that was the way of it. After doing your work, you simply walked off and made for your rooms. That sort of thing succeeds sometimes. I suppose it was agreed beforehand that, once the business over, each of you would go his own way? Razumov preserved the seriousness of his expression and the deliberate, if cautious, manner of speaking. Was not that the best thing to do, he asked, in a dispassionate tone. And anyway, he added, after waiting a moment, we did not give much thought to what would come after. We never discussed formally any line of conduct. It was understood, I think. She approved his statement with slight nods. You, of course, wish to remain in Russia? In St. Petersburg itself, emphasized Razumov. Tea was the only safe course for me. And, moreover, I had nowhere else to go. Yes. Yes. I know. Clearly. And the other, this wonderful Alden appearing, only to be regretted, you don't know what he intended? Razumov had foreseen that such a question would certainly come to meet him sooner or later. He raised his hands a little and let them fall helplessly by his side, nothing more. It was the white-haired woman conspirator who was the first to break the silence. "Very curious," she pronounced slowly. "And you did not think, Kirill Sidorovich, that he might perhaps wish to get in touch with you again?" Razumov discovered that he could not suppress the trembling of his lips. But he thought that he owed it to himself to speak. A negative sign would not do again. Speak he must, if only to get at the bottom of what that St. Petersburg letter might have contained. "I stayed at home next day," he said, bending down a little and plunging his glance into the black eyes of the woman, so that she should not observe the trembling of his lips. "Yes, I stayed at home. As my actions are remembered and written about, then perhaps you are aware that I was not seen at the lectures next day. Eh? You didn't know? Well, I stopped at home the livelong day." As if moved by his agitated tone, she murmured a sympathetic, "See, it must have been trying enough." "You seem to understand one's feelings," said Razumov steadily. "He was trying. It was horrible. It was an atrocious day. It was not the last." "Yes, I understand. Afterwards, when you heard they had got him. Don't I know how one feels after losing a comrade in the good fight? One's ashamed of being left. And I can remember so many. Never mind. They shall be avenged before long. And what is death? At any rate, it is not a shameful thing like some kinds of life." Razumov felt something stir in his breast, a sort of feeble and unpleasant tremor. "Some kinds of life?" he repeated, looking at her searchingly. "The subservient, submissive life. Life? No. Vegetation on the filthy heap of iniquity which the world is. Life, Razumov, not to be vile must be a revolt, a pitiless protest all the time." She calmed down, the gleam of suffused tears in her eyes dried out instantly by the heat of her passion, and it was in her capable business-like manner that she went on, "You understand me, Razumov. You are not an enthusiast, but there is an immense force of revolt in you. I felt it from the first, directly I set my eyes on you, you remember in Zurich. Oh, you are full of bitter revolt. That is good. Indignation flags sometimes, revenge itself may become a weariness, but that uncompromising sense of necessity and justice which armed your and Alden's hands to strike down that fanatical brute. For it was that nothing but that. I have been thinking it out. It could have been nothing else but that." Razumov made a slight bow, the irony of which was concealed by an almost sinister immobility of feature. "I can't speak for the dead. As for myself, I can assure you that my conduct was dictated by necessity and by the sense of well-retributive justice." "Good, that," he said to himself, while her eyes rested upon him, black and impenetrable like the mental caverns where revolutionary thought should sit plotting the violent way of its stream of changes. As if anything could be changed. In this world of men nothing can be changed, neither happiness nor misery. They can only be displaced at the cost of corrupted consciences, and broken lives a futile game for arrogant philosophers and sanguinary triflers. Those thoughts darted through Razumov's head, while he stood facing the old revolutionary hand, the respected, trusted, and influential Sofia Antonovna, whose word had such a weight in the dive section of every party. She was much more representative than the great Peter Ivanovich. Stripped of rhetoric, mysticism, and theories, she was the true spirit of destructive revolution. And she was the personal adversary he had to meet. It gave him a feeling of triumphant pleasure to deceive her out of her own mouth. The epigrammatic saying, "That speech has been given to us for the purpose of concealing our thoughts," came into his mind. Of that cynical theory this was a very subtle and a very scornful application, flouting in its own words the very spirit of ruthless revolution, embodied in that woman with her white hair and black eyebrows, like slightly sinuous lines of Indian ink, drawn together by the perpendicular folds of a thoughtful frown. That's it. Retributive. No pity, was the conclusion of her silence. And this once broken, she went on impulsively in short, vibrating sentences, listen to my story, Razumov. Her father was a clever but unlucky artisan. No joy had lighted up his laborious days. He died at 50. All the years of his life he had panted under the thumb of masters whose rapacity exacted from him the price of the water, of the salt, of the very air he breathed, taxed the sweat of his brow, and claimed the blood of his sons. No protection, no guidance. What had society to say to him? Be submissive and be honest. If you rebel, I shall kill you. If you steal, I shall imprison you. But if you suffer, I have nothing for you, nothing except perhaps a beggarly dole of bread, but no consolation for your trouble, no respect for your manhood, no pity for the sorrows of your miserable life. And so he labored, he suffered, and he died. He died in the hospital. Standing by the common grave, she thought of his tormented existence, she saw it all. She reckoned the simple joys of life, the birthright of the humblest, of which his gentle heart had been robbed by the crime of a society which nothing can absolve. Yes, Razumov, she continued, in an impressive, lowered voice, it was like a lurid light in which I stood, still almost a child, and cursed not the toil, not the misery which had been his lot, but the great social iniquity of the system resting on unrequited toil and unpitied sufferings. From that moment I was a revolutionist. Razumov, trying to raise himself above the dangerous weaknesses of contempt or compassion, had preserved an impassive countenance. She, with an unaffected touch of mere bitterness, the first he could notice, since he had come in contact with the woman, went on, as I could not go to the church, where the priests of the system exhorted such unconsidered vermin as I to resignation, I went to the secret societies, as soon as I knew how to find my way. I was 16 years old no more, Razumov. And look at my white hair. In these last words there was neither pride nor sadness. The bitterness too was gone. There is a lot of it. I had always magnificent hair, even as a chit of a girl. Only, at that time we were cutting it short and thinking that there was the first step towards crushing the social infamy. Crush the infamy. A fine watchword. I would placard it on the walls of prisons and palaces, carve it on hard rocks, hang it out in letters of fire on that empty sky for a sign of hope and terror, a portent of the end. You are eloquent, Sofia Antonovna, Razumov interrupted suddenly. Why, so far you seem to have been writing it in water. She was checked but not offended. Who knows? Very soon it may become a fact written all over that great land of ours, she hinted meaningly. And then one would have lived long enough. White hair won't matter. Razumov looked at her white hair. And this mark of so many uneasy years seemed nothing but a testimony to the invincible vigor of revolt. It threw out into an astonishing relief the unwrinkled face, the brilliant black glance, the upright compact figure, the simple, brisk self-possession of the mature personality, as though in her revolutionary pilgrimages he had discovered the secret, not of everlasting youth, but of everlasting endurance. How un-Russian she looked, thought Razumov. Her mother might have been a Jewess, or an Armenian or devil knew what. He reflected that a revolutionist is seldom true to the settled type. All revolt is the expression of strong individualism, ran his thought vaguely. One can tell them a mile off in any society, in any surroundings. It was astonishing that the police. We shall not meet again very soon, I think, she was saying. I'm leaving tomorrow. For Zurich? Razumov asked casually, but feeling relieved, not from any distinct apprehension, but from a feeling of stress, as if after a wrestling match. Yes, Zurich and farther on, perhaps, much farther. Another journey. When I think of all my journeys, the last must come someday. Never mind, Razumov. We had to have a good long talk. I would have certainly tried to see you, if we had not met. Peter Ivanovich knows where you live? Yes. I meant to have asked him, but it's better like this. You see, we expect two more men, and I had much rather wait here talking with you than up there at the house with... Dot dot. Having cast a glance beyond the gate, she interrupted herself. Here they are, she said rapidly. El, Kirillo Sidorovich, we shall have to say goodbye, presently. IV, in his incertitude of the ground on which he stood, Razumov felt perturbed. Turning his head quickly, he saw two men on the opposite side of the road. Seeing themselves noticed by Sofia Antonovna, they crossed over at once, and passed one after another through the little gate by the side of the empty lodge. They looked hard at the stranger, but without mistrust, the crimson blouse being a flaring safety signal. The first, great white hairless face, double chin, prominent stomach, which he seemed to carry forward consciously within a strongly distended overcoat, only nodded and averted his eyes peevishly. His companion lean, flushed cheekbones, a military red mustache below a sharp, salient nose approached at once Sofia Antonovna, greeting her warmly. His voice was very strong but inarticulate. It sounded like a deep buzzing. The woman revolutionist was quietly cordial. This is Razumov, she announced in a clear voice. The lean newcomer made an eager half-turn. He will want to embrace me. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.